A long time ago, before I moved to Dallas, long before I actually settled down in central Illinois with Lisa, I was working in retail, and we had a competition going between us and several other stores in the region. A truck was coming with pallets full of product, as well as promotional gear, cans that could be sold. The idea was the stores were to create the best display for the product, using all of the product itself, the swag, whatever we could do to creatively spotlight this product. Well, the truck arrives, and I talk to my receiver, and I let him know, hey, here's what I need you to do for us tonight. I need you first to unload the truck, then take all the shrink wrap off of the pallets, and then I want you to take those pallets to the front of the store. You don't need to unload them, just bring them up to the front of the store so the morning crew, who's coming in early, will be able to get started on unloading and creating the display. This was important because he was the only one who had the forklift license. Everyone that was going to be there that morning, with a couple of exceptions, weren't allowed to drive the forklift. So I left him at the end of my day, expecting that everything would go well. Sure enough, the next morning I get a phone call from one of the assistant managers letting me know that all of the product, all of the display materials, everything is still back in receiving. So when I called the receiver to task on this, he justified his decision. He rationalized it this way. Well, you asked me to unload the truck, to take off the shrink wrap, and to get everything ready, so I did the most important stuff. I did what you asked me to do. The truck was able to leave. All of the product was in the store. All people needed to do was bring the product up to the front. Now, this is just a perfect example of how partial obedience isn't obedience. Going halfway is not completing the journey. Having good intentions and rationalizations as to why you couldn't do the whole thing, it still leaves the whole thing undone. Well, this morning we're continuing our look at the life of Jacob. And in chapter 32, we saw that moment of struggle and transformation. That moment where Jacob, who had been striving, manipulating, controlling, grasping his entire life, found himself in a wrestling match with God himself, ending the only way such a wrestling match can end, clinging desperately to God, exhausted, strength spent, wounded, and asking for a blessing. Relying wholly on God. That is a turning point in the narrative, right? That's the moment that Jacob is given a new name. It shall no longer be said of him that he is deceiver. Instead, now his name will be Israel, which means God contends or God fights for you. A huge moment. Well, we pick up this morning with chapter 33. This is what everything has been building towards ever since we knew that Jacob would be leaving Haran and coming back home. He has to face his brother, Esau, the one from whom he swindled the birthright, the one from whom he stole the blessing. The one that caused him to run, to leave at his mother's urging because Esau would surely kill him. It's the whole reason he ended up working for Laban for those 20 years in the first place. And now, after this wrestling match with God, a new day dawns upon Jacob, and he limps into camp, prepared to face his brother Esau. So as we're looking at this story, we're going to see two key moves. The first is the actual encounter with Esau, and then what choices Jacob has to make after he and Esau go their separate ways. partial obedience. It's not obedience at all. Let's start. Chapter 33, verse 1. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming with 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two female servants. And he put the servants with their children in front, and then Leah with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. I want you to notice something here. In 32, when he got word that Esau was coming with 400 men, a sizable militia, what did he do? He divided into two camps. He figured, I'll cut my losses. If he takes out one of these camps, maybe the other one will survive. It was a survival technique. What he does now, on the heels of this miraculous encounter with God, he's not strategizing to survive anymore. Instead of dividing into two groups to protect, he's dividing into four groups to present. Here are the mothers of my children and my children. And another key aspect is different, and we see that in verse 3. He himself went on before them, bowing himself to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. Notice this. He's no longer protecting himself. He's no longer hiding behind everyone else. He's no longer, you know, for once in my life, I think being last is okay. He creates this processional, and then he puts himself to the front, bowing and ingratiating himself to Esau. Almost overkill. This bowing seven times is what a conquered king would do when they were coming before Pharaoh, for example. Seven times they would bow to the ground. And here comes Jacob, bowing. A little much, but at the same time, the shame of what Jacob did to secure the birthright has been weighing down on him. And now he comes forward broken, contrite, humbled. It's interesting, right? Because the blessing that Rebecca received in that dream, the blessing that he had stolen from his brother, said something very explicit, that the older would bow before the younger. Yet here now comes Jacob bowing before his brother. There's hints. As we're here in 33, there are hints of a change that have occurred in Jacob. Coming up in the front, bowing before his brother, the fact that he's no longer running. These are pictures of Israel, his new name, the one for whom God fights. Yet this is something that I found to be interesting. When Abram had his name changed to Abraham, from that point forward, the narrator calls him Abraham. He's not called Abram again. Yet here with Jacob, his new name is Israel. Yet already the text is calling him Jacob. In fact, if you keep reading through Genesis, you'll see that he is called Jacob 45 more times after his name has been changed. And only 23 times is he called by his new name, Israel. I don't want to read too much into this, but as we'll see as this chapter continues, there is still much of Jacob in Israel. And that's important for us to recognize, not just in the narrative that we're reading, but as we reflect on what it is that we are to be learning from this text. So, he has bowed before his brother seven times until he comes near. And then verse 4, but Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell upon his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Jacob limps towards Esau. Esau runs towards Jacob. I don't think Jacob saw this coming, but here is his brother, the one he was so fearful of. The night before, he prayed, "My brother's going to kill me. Deliver me, O God." And here he is, overjoyed and weeping to see his long-absent brother. You know, there's one other occasion in the story of Jacob and Esau where five verbs are used in rapid-fire sequence, just as they are now. Esau ran, embraced, fell, kissed, and wept. If you jump back all the way to chapter 25, verse 34, this is the moment where Jacob steals the birthright, and we saw the five verbs relating to the stew. He ate, he drank, he rose, he went, he despised his birthright. Esau is still Esau. Esau is still driven. He's driven by what is before him. But here we have this beautiful demonstration of love. He fell on his neck and kissed him. And I can't help but to remember that one of the ways that Jacob deceived Isaac into believing that he was Esau was through a kiss. And now his brother is kissing him, restoring him. Verse 5. And when Esau lifted up his eyes and saw the women and children, he said, Who are these with you? Jacob said, The children whom God has graciously given your servant. Then the servants drew near, they and their children, and bowed down. Leah, likewise, and her children drew near and bowed down. And last, Joseph and Rachel drew near, and they bowed down. The order is significant. There's still favoritism going on in Jacob's unhealthy family. Esau said, What do you mean by all this company that I have met? Jacob answered, To find favor in the sight of my Lord. Honesty. For once, Jacob is being honest. He's not spinning anything. He is being upfront at the moment with his brother Esau. What do I mean by this company? I don't mean a threat. I just want to find favor in your eyes. But Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. Remember, over 500 animals sent in droves in the previous chapter as gifts. Esau was likely surrounded by the gifts that his brother had sent him. And now he's telling Jacob, hey, I have enough. I don't need all of this. Keep it for yourself. Which, by the way, that was a custom in the ancient Near East. It's still a custom today that when the offer is given, that initially there's a refusal. And then the offer is given again. And this is significant. That's exactly what's happening. Jacob said, No, please, if I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand. For I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. Please accept my blessing, not my gift. Please accept my blessing that is brought to you. Because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. Thus, he urged him, and he took it. So here we have the two brothers, separated now for over 20 years. Jacob having stolen the birthright and the blessing, and as we have seen over these past weeks, struggled for 20 years, but now has plenty. Has been blessed greatly by God. But here's Esau. Esau, the brother that was stolen from. Remember, he begged his father, Isaac, do you not have any blessing for me? And Isaac gave him a blessing, such as it was. But one of the aspects of that blessing is that he would prosper through war. And here we have Esau, strong, powerful, warrior Esau, saying, hey, I have enough. Jacob has prospered as a shepherd, as a worker, as a farmer. His brother Esau has prospered as a warrior, as a man and implement of violence. He has enough. In what way is seeing Esau's face like seeing the face of God? Jacob expected this meeting to go down in a certain way. After he had wrestled with God the night before, he was no longer fearful. He saw that for what it is, that God is striving for me. So he came and he approached his brother, but with all of these gifts and this presentation and this exaggerated humility and this obsequious language, he expected that I will need to make restitution to my brother. I will need to restore to him the blessing that I stole, and then maybe he will lift up his face and he will receive me, he will forgive me, and we will be restored. That's what happened, but in the exact opposite order. Before Jacob had a chance to present his family and to insist upon accepting this blessing or this gift, Esau has already restored him. Esau has already accepted him, greeting him with a hug and with a kiss and weeping. This is the way it is with God. We don't merit our own grace. We don't earn his favor. He blesses us abundantly, not because of who we are or what we've done, but because of who he is and how gracious and loving he is. Such a beautiful picture of God's grace. It's also significant that Jacob had to deal with God first the night before he went to meet with Esau. We need to be right before God before we have a chance or a hope of standing rightly before men. We see this pattern repeated over and over in Scripture. Here, of course, with the story of Jacob and Esau. But we look at the Ten Commandments that Moses receives. The first four have to do with our relationship, our rightness, our worship, our posture towards God. And then the next six, how we should be responding to our fellow men. When Jesus was asked in Matthew 22, how do you summarize all of the law and the prophets? You remember what Jesus said. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love God. Love your brother. Jacob is following that order now. He's been forgiven by his brother. He has restored the blessing that he has stolen. And again, this is significant as we think about the culture of the ancient Near East. Esau was urged to take it, the blessing, and he did. Full stop. No reciprocation. No, I insist that you take these, my brother Jacob. No, not there. Why? Because Esau knew what this was. This was restitution. He accepted what Jacob gave him, and it's forgiven. This was not cheap grace. This was costly, and it is now paid in full. And in fact, we don't see Esau again until Isaac's funeral, but the fact the two brothers are able to come together at the death of Isaac shows that this restoration is true. It's legitimate. So in this section, we see Jacob has changed. Jacob is now leading with a limp. He is now in front of his family instead of protecting himself. He is honest with his brother instead of trying to lie and to twist and deceive. He may be a little over the top in ingratiating himself to his brother, but he is seeking restoration of this relationship. Well, let's move on. Verse 12. Then Esau said, "Let us journey on our way, and I will go ahead of you." In other words, Jacob, come, you and your family, come with me down to Edom. Come to Seir. Let us be together. But Jacob said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are frail, and that the nursing flocks and herds are a care to me. If they are driven hard for just one day, all the flocks will die. He's not wrong, right? Esau is there with 400 men, a militia. These are warriors and hunters, and they travel at a very different pace and in a very different way than a nomadic herdsman with flocks and family. So it is a very different way of traveling. Also, God's command to Jacob was to go where? To go home, to go to Canaan, to go to Bethel, to the place where God revealed himself to Jacob. So going down south to Edom with his brother would be disobeying God. So here Jacob is doing the right thing, but in a questionable way. This is one of the reasons I suspect that Jacob is being called Jacob here and not Israel, because he's misdirecting. He's not saying to his brother, Esau, thank you. You honor me by inviting me to come with you. But God has commanded me to return to the land of our father. So we must part here, and my family and I must go back home. Arguably, that's exactly what Jacob should have done. But that's not what he did. Instead, he rationalizes. He misdirects. He gives an excuse. And then he goes even farther. Verse 14. Let my Lord pass on ahead of his servant, and I will lead on slowly at the pace of the livestock that are ahead of me and at the pace of the children until I come to my Lord in Seir. Well, now he's moved from exaggeration or misdirection and straight into deceit. He has no intention of going down to Edom. That's not his plan. It may be that he does not yet fully trust his brother. It may be that he desires to obey the command of God, but now in obeying the command of God, he is using exaggeration, misdirection, and deceit to do it. That certainly sounds like the old Jacob and not the new Israel. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. As I mentioned a moment ago, this is the last time we see him. We're done. We're done with Esau. The saga, the drama of Jacob and Esau, the brothers who are struggling and grasping at each other, it's essentially over. I love the way one commentator put it. The man who despised his birthright steps off the pages of salvation history. The visionless man has no part in the eternal kingdom of God. Remember, there is something that Esau does not have that Jacob now does. And that's faith. Jacob's faith is an imperfect faith, just as our faith is an imperfect faith. But Esau, he sees what's in front of him, and that's it. He does not have a vision of what that birthright meant. And now he's out of the story. And Jacob continues on. He exaggerated. He lied. But now, is he going to obey? Is he going to move forward and head into the promised land to do that which God has called him to do? Well, let's see. But Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. The word Succoth means booths or stables. Well, let me highlight something here. Succoth is not Bethel. Succoth is not in Canaan. Succoth is north, just over the Jabbok River that he had forded the night before. This is a step backwards from actual obedience. And so he settles in Succoth. Why? The text isn't explicit. And I don't know. It could be that he still a little bit fearful of going home and seeing his father Isaac, whom he deceived. It could be that he's still a little fearful of his brother Esau, because he is an emotional, temperamental man, and we would imagine he would make that journey regularly to see his father. We don't know, but what we do know is he did not go into Canaan yet. He did not go to Bethel. And he didn't just pause in Succoth and refresh. He built a house there. And then, verse 18, and Jacob came safely. We don't know how long this is, but we can imagine, having built a house in Succoth, it's a season at least. And Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, on his way from Paddan Aram, and he camped before the city. So I've seen different things from different commentators, but the text says in the land of Canaan, so I'm going to say that Shechem is in the land of Canaan. It is on the far south border there. It's not, once again, Bethel, the place where he was called to return. So he is obeying partially. Partial obedience, again, is not the same as obedience. I think about just in our own home, when the kitchen garbage gets full, the request is often made, hey, take the garbage out to the can. And what often happens is that the garbage gets taken out of the kitchen garbage can, and it makes it to the garage and down those steps, and that's where it lives. It stays there until someone else, usually me, sometimes Lisa, and sometimes, by the way, I'm the one who just puts it at the bottom of the stairs, full disclosure. It's not in the can. That's partial obedience. It didn't make it all the way. Well, what does it matter? It's out of the kitchen, so we can use the kitchen garbage can. Well, there are critters that live in our neck of the woods, and a garbage bag in the garage, as opposed to in the garbage can, is easily torn into and scattered and spread around. Partial obedience, going halfway, is not going the entire distance. A more dramatic example would be that of safety. When we tell children, don't play near the road, don't play on the road, stay off of the road, I don't want you to get hit by a car. Well, if the kid is playing in the ditch or on the shoulder, well, they're partially obeying. They're not in the road. They're kind of on the road, but partial obedience is not obedience, and that is what we are seeing here from Jacob. So he comes to Shechem, verse 19, and from the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, he bought for 100 pieces of money the piece of land on which he had pitched his tent. There he erected an altar and called it El Elohi Israel. This seems like a good end to the story. It seems like Jacob has been faithful, and he's returned to Canaan, and he has erected an altar to the powerful God, the Most High God over Israel, over Jacob. A cursory look at it would say, yeah, well done. Good job, Jacob. But again, Shechem isn't Bethel. Shechem isn't home. It's not where Isaac lives. He has partially obeyed. And as we will see next week as we move to chapter 34, Jacob's decision to partially obey and to settle in Succoth and Shechem is going to cost him and his family and his reputation dearly. There will be consequences for this halfway obedience. How do you and I rationalize partial obedience? There are things that I suspect we all do that we know, well, this is the right thing to do, and so I'm doing it. But to actually obey would be to go several steps beyond just the visual. One illustration of that would be the cultural phenomenon of church on Sunday mornings. There are those who their entire Christian life is summed up in that period of time on Sunday morning. The rest of the week belongs to them, but they'll give that hour and 15 minutes to God. I would say that that is partial obedience, which is not obedience at all. Our lives are to be living sacrifices for the glory of God. I'm sure there are countless other examples that we could think through, but I want to put that question on your heart this morning. How do we rationalize almost? How do we rationalize halfway? How do we justify that partial obedience? Where have we erected altars to give God glory that are not actually in the places where God has called us to be? As I look at the life of Jacob, we can all learn from him. We need to be aware of what our strengths are, our natural strengths and abilities, and then recognize the potential pitfalls, the ways in which those strengths can give us the illusion that we aren't totally dependent upon God. We need to remember we limp and we desperately depend. Partial obedience is actually complete disobedience. It's a delusion to trick ourselves into saying that we have been faithful when we've only gone halfway. As we look at chapter 33, a very straightforward chapter on one hand, but with an undercurrent of Jacob still doing things his own way underneath. Jacob's limp and his new name, they fade as he forgets about his humility and his desperate dependence upon God. He lied to his brother. He wasted time in Succoth. He settled in the wrong city. And by proclaiming his God at Shechem, he demonstrated he wasn't submitting to his God in Bethel. What guides our decisions? Our preferences, our comforts, our fears? One of the most powerful lessons that I've taken from the text this morning as I've been wrestling through it, no pun intended, how often do I make significant decisions in my life without consulting God, without remembering that I am totally dependent upon Him and Him alone, that any strength that I appear to have is simply on loan to me, and He ultimately is the one who provides? Am I going to listen to the one who guides? As you face different decisions this week, this month, whether they're small or large, let's take time. Let's take time in prayer, the study of God's Word, and in the context of community to not try to do this on our own. Let us not be Jacob's, leaning into partial, incomplete, halfway obedience. Let us instead be Israel's, depending totally upon God, clinging to Him for all we are worth, because He is the one from whom we truly receive blessing.